Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 23, 2026. Salt and Light nonprofit dumps inventory after bed bugs found. Loss estimated at $45,000. Changes in works to avoid any future infestations. A nonprofit thrift store is facing significant financial loss after clearing out its clothing inventory due to bed bugs. Salt and Light co-founder and executive director Nathan Montgomery said the store at 1819 South Philo Road, which also sells groceries and other household goods, remained open while all clothing was removed. He was notified Monday afternoon that bed bugs had been found in storage at the back of the warehouse, which is when he made the decision to dispose of all clothing inventory from the back as well as the sales floor out of an abundance of caution. Thankfully, we've already been able to get everything out and a clean bill of health from our pest control people and began refilling racks with new items yesterday afternoon, he said Wednesday. I estimate the financial loss at about $45,000 between the lost recycling revenue and sales, along with the increased labor and trash expense to mitigate the problem. As for furniture, Montgomery said that there were only a few pieces on the floor, which the store was able to inspect and did not have to throw away, and no furniture was at risk at the back of the warehouse. Additionally, Salt and Light's drop-off site in Champaign was not affected. Montgomery told the News Gazette that the store cannot know for certain if the bed bugs came in on donated items or on volunteers. He noted that one of the reasons for the nonprofit's decision to get rid of all clothing was that Salt and Light's salvage partners would not want material with any potential threat of bed bugs. "We recycle textiles that don't get sold through the store," he explained, "so all clothing, shoes, belts, and purses actually in and of themselves generate revenue, even if that's stuff that wouldn't sell. And so we get a price per pound for that from the same different buyers." Textile recycling typically generates about $350,000 to $400,000 per year for the nonprofit, while also keeping goods out of landfills, Montgomery estimated. Between clothing that was already packed into bales for recycling and loose items, Salt and Light is working to dispose about 40 tons of clothing. He added that the nonprofit has implemented a number of process improvements to mitigate the risk of this happening again. "This includes during initial inspections of donated clothing and furniture outside of the warehouse to isolate any bed bugs that are found, educating people about what to look for, and getting some black lights to help spot the pests." There's a photo on the front page of the News Gazette with the headline, "All in the Family," and the caption says, "About 30 of the purple dad clad people pictured here will be on hand at Chelona's Polly Anderson Auditorium at 7 p.m. tonight when the Lutz family of Old Orchard and Lynx and Pizza Fame is inducted into the Unity High School Alumni Hall of Fame," Jordan Lutz said on Wednesday's edition of News Gazette Radio, powered by GTPS Insurance. "All five of 1950s Unity student Jim and Joe's children, and all 12 of their grandchildren, from Kathy, class of 75, to Tatum, class of 24, are proud former Rockets and part of a family that built more than a business. They created a gathering place for the community and a legacy of service that continues to connect generations of Unity graduates." Their Hall of Fame bio reads, "The family that helped bring the sport of bowling to the high school will share tonight's spotlight with fellow inductees Dean Chestnut and Joe Thomas." Retiring professor packs house with not-so-final lecture. Earlier this week, hundreds of students, former students, family members, and more gathered to listen to one University of Illinois professor's final lecture. Well, it wasn't exactly his final lecture. The College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, Paul Stoddard, is quick to say. First of all, he isn't dying. Second, he still has a semester to finish. "The very first time I ever taught anything ever was in the historic Lincoln Hall," Stoddard recalls. "I was absolutely scared. I was so intimidated." After graduating from the U of I himself with a degree in economics, Stoddard went on to work in the agricultural business field, initially in farm management. 20 years later, he was working as the chief appraiser at Farm Credits Illinois. Only his wife knew that he was dreaming of the opportunity to teach at the U of I. It was a goal that seemed preposterous, Stoddard said. I didn't tell anybody except my wife, because everybody else would have said, that's ridiculous. He made some efforts to pursue teaching experience through a professional organization he's part of, but not much came of it. That is, until 5 years later, when someone who was meant to teach an appraisal class at the U of I wasn't able to do so anymore. Someone who Stoddard had spoken to about learning to teach recommended him for the job, and he got it. He learned on the job, discovering little things about how to help students learn more effectively. For example, Stoddard initially didn't want to patronize these smart university students by repeating the same thing more than once. And then I gave the first exam, he said. No, repetition is a teaching technique. Fortunately for Stoddard, he loves learning. After 25 years on the job, he said he still feels like he's learning every day. He reads plenty and can quote experts on success in education conversationally. He helps other teachers sharing full semester plans if they so desire. I'm a big believer in learning and that anybody can get better at anything, Stoddard said. One of the satisfying things for me is that I feel like I'm still getting better. The important part, and this is a hard little bit sometimes, if you have got to pay attention to feedback. Stoddard says he puts a lot of stock into what students say in feedback. If his Rate My Professional Professor.com scores are anything to go by, it's often positive. It's after the connection more than the knowledge transfer, he said. Once you make that connection, the knowledge transfer is a whole lot easier. He says he runs into former students all the time and is surprised to find them remembering things he taught them, sometimes even verbatim. At his final lecture Tuesday night, he saw around 150 people gather in Follinger Auditorium, and he estimated another 100 joined online. He answered common questions from students about his own journey and shared wisdom he's learned over the years in important parts of his experience. The stairs he takes to his office in Mumford Hall are marble. They're worn from being used, and they're the same steps he took as a student 50 years ago. He'll be taking them at least a few more times as he finishes out this last semester. Capital News report Illinois stalls in efforts to expand preschool programs. A new report from the National Institute for Early Education Research found Illinois' rate of growth in enrollment and funding for universal preschool is slowing, despite state efforts to expand preschool programming. While the report noted Governor J.B. Pritzker's Smart Start initiative increased access in recent years, flat funding for the current year has stalled progress in the state. Pritzker introduced Smart Start Illinois in 2023, a program that aims to expand high-quality publicly funded preschool programs to low-income children. In January 2025, Pritzker announced the addition of more than 5,000 seats to the program, for a total of 11,000 since it began. Per the report, the state ranked fourth in three-year-old enrollment in the 24-25 school year. However, it ranked 22nd in state funding and 20th for four-year-old enrollment out of all 50 states and Washington, D.C. Over the past 5 years, three-year-old enrollment in Illinois has slowly increased to 26%, although it remains lower than enrollment for four-year-olds, which plateaued at 35%. Most state-funded preschool programs primarily serve four-year-olds, with nationwide enrollment reaching 37% for four-year-olds, but only 9% for three-year-olds. Illinois rises to the top of three-year-olds because most states aren't doing anything, and Illinois serves similar percentages of three- and four-year-olds, said the report's authors, Steve Barnett and Allison Friedman Krause. Illinois has a two-year preschool program that targets both ages. During the 24-25 school year, Illinois preschools enrolled about 83,000 children in total, an increase of more than 1,000 students from the previous year. The report released Wednesday found that the state met 8 of the 10 quality benchmarks for the Institute set for early childhood education in 24-25. Illinois' rating was in line with the national trend. Enrollment and funding saw record highs, but the pace of growth in those categories showed from the previous years. The Governor's Smart Start initiative includes the Early Childhood Block Grant program, which makes grants available for children in preschool deserts. The report found that Illinois' spending per child has increased to $6,641 over the past 2 years, reversing a decrease from 2021 to 2023. State spending increased 7% in total from the 23-24 school year to the 24-25 year, when adjusted for inflation, an increase of about 5% per child. Top of the morning, something to get you going today, courtesy of Vice President Jim Rosso. Philanthropic All-Stars David Kenyon and David Alban were back at it last week's Kickin' Cancer fundraiser at Gordyville, reached deep into their pockets to make for a record night of giving, $700,000 plus. Kenyon successfully bid on a pair of Brad Underwood's Coaches vs. Cancer shoes, like he's done for 3 consecutive years, but upped his donation $11,000 when the coach's orange Eastern European jumpsuit was added to the package. He'll display the shoes and the jumpsuit at the bar he owns in Gifford, the Alley. It's exciting to not just walk away with some hardware, but to be able to give that money to a good cause, he said. Alban bid $20,500 for Underwood's Nikes that featured country flags of the many international Illini on roster. Players signed on their flag, which was pretty cool, said Alban, president of Longview Capital Corporation, where he'll display the shoes. The Newman native is a prostate cancer survivor who is happy to chip in. It's for a good cause, and it's close to my heart, too, he said. The teacher of the week is Heather Nolan, pre-kindergarten, Urbana Early Childhood School. Heading into college at Eastern Illinois University after graduating from Sullivan High School, Heather Nolan thought she would become a high school English teacher. This was until I was introduced to the world of special education, Nolan said. Nolan, who was legally blind as a child, understands the hurdles that children with special needs face. She double majored in special education and early childhood education, and she spent the last 13 years of her 15-year career at Urbana Early Childhood School. Heather is warm, kind, and welcoming to her students, as well as staff, Principal Katie Mulligan said. She has been a teacher mentor and lead mentor for our new staff for many years. She is so helpful in helping new staff become acclimated to our building. She has developed a strong classroom structure where her students thrive. Despite the fact that she does not speak French fluently, she has taken on the responsibility of having a French-speaking teaching assistant and many French-speaking students. She has been learning how to communicate with the students in their home language. I find my work important because I can see the impact that teaching has every day. In my classroom, I am the general education teacher, the special education teacher, and the English as a second language teacher. I work with a diverse group of students. Every day I get to be a part of their learning and growth and celebrate with my scholars all the milestones they accomplished, whether it is writing their first words or learning to stack blocks to build a tower. These aha moments are the most fulfilling moments. I became a teacher because I have a passion for learning and supporting others in achieving their goals. I love that teaching is a profession where we never stop learning. In our school, we engage in inquiry-based learning experiences, and so I get to follow the students' lead for deciding what we will investigate and learn about. This has led me to learn about things I never would have thought of learning about. I am part of our school leadership team, which challenges me to learn about topics that affect our students and teachers at a deeper level. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is currently an immersive read aloud with the book Baby Goes to Market by Antonuk. This is a story about a mother and her baby in an African market, where, while the mother is doing her shopping, the baby receives treats from the vendors in the market. He always eats just one part of the treat and puts the rest in the mother's basket. At the end of the story, the mother is very surprised to find all these extra items in her basket. My students worked to create materials we would need to act out the story. Then we turned the classroom into the market, and the students helped recreate the story as I read the book. They are so invested and engaged in this lesson, and they learn concepts such as decomposing sets, story elements, language development, writing, peer interactions, and much more. We have also recently begun an engineering unit, with one of our focus texts being the story of the three little pigs, and are looking forward to creating an immersive read-aloud for this story as well. I keep students engaged by keeping them active in and taking ownership of our learning experiences and meeting them where they are. I look and listen for students' interests and embed those into our learning environment and experiences. I have high expectations for all students in my classroom, and I and my team work to scaffold and differentiate learning to support students in meeting those high expectations. I use a lot of visuals and gestures for supporting communication and understanding directions. I believe that learning should be a fun and active process. My favorite teacher and subject to study in school were, I had some pretty great teachers growing up, but the one that was the most impactful on my life was Miss Lawson at Sullivan High School. She was my high school English teacher, which was my favorite subject to study, and was the teacher of the and was the leader of the drama club. Miss Lawson made me feel supported, cared about, and was always so patient. These are characteristics that I aspired to bring into my own classroom. Something else I am passionate about, aside from teaching, is my family and training my dog. I guess I am passionate about a communication because I felt that even our dog should have a way to communicate with us. So I taught her to use talk buttons. She has 8 words that she uses to communicate her wants and needs. I love seeing her excitement when we understand what she wants. If I weren't a teacher and could do any job I wanted, I would have a rescue dog ranch similar to the show Lucky Dog on CBS. I would love to train and help rescue dogs and find their forever homes and learn a few words along the way. Study of COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness won't be published. Officials claim problem with its commonly used methodology. U.S. health officials stopped the publication of a study on whether the COVID-19 vaccine was keeping adults from becoming sick enough to have to go to the hospital. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services spokesman on Wednesday confirmed the decision to halt publication, citing a dispute about the study's methodology. The research paper was to appear in Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention flagship publication. One way scientists have studied COVID-19 vaccine effectiveness is by focusing on sick people who were admitted to hospitals or visited emergency rooms. The researchers check whether patients were vaccinated and then calculate the odds of a positive COVID-19 test among vaccinated patients versus those who were unvaccinated. Papers using that methodology have been published after review by experts in the field and a number of esteemed journals, including Pediatrics and the New England Journal of Medicine. Following the same approach, the new study concluded that the vaccine cut ER visits and hospitalizations among otherwise healthy adults by about half this past winter, according to the Washington Post, which first reported the cancellation. HHS officials did not say exactly why that methodology was a problem in this instance, but argued that prior infection behavior and differences in who seeks care can affect results. The wider scientific community does not have these concerns, and many researchers have used this approach, said Dr. Fiona Havers, an Atlanta-based doctor who previously worked at CDC. The methodology is built to address differences related to those who seek care, and prior infection shouldn't be much of an issue because so many Americans have been infected by the coronavirus, she added. No study design is perfect, but HHS officials haven't proposed an alternative. That's realistic and ethical for getting real-time estimates of how well vaccines are working each year, said Havers, who once led a CDC hospital network surveillance team that focused on COVID-19 and other respiratory viruses. During President Donald Trump's first administration, public health advocates worried that the political appointees were trying to control what was being published in the weekly report. Those concerns returned last year when Trump returned to office and publication of the report was temporarily suspended. It returned but has remained a thinner version of its former self. Healthcare professionals rely on MMWR for timely, objective, and fact-based information about the nation's public health, says U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois, who voiced concern when CDC communications were halted last year. Muzzling scientists and doctors on how to prevent Americans from being hospitalized can have deadly consequences. The CDC must abandon plans to place a political gag order on the critical research, Durbin said in a statement Wednesday. Wildfires force evacuations across Georgia and Florida. Wildfires burning across southeastern U.S. forced more people to flee Wednesday after destroying nearly 50 homes in Georgia and causing some school closings as drought and winds fueled flames. Some of the biggest blazes were near Georgia's coast, while others were popping up in northern Florida, a state facing one of its worst fire seasons in decades. It was not clear how the wildfires started, but the bottom half of Georgia is perilously dry, and the conditions prompted the state's Forestry Commission to issue a burn ban for the first time in its history. Southeastern Georgia has seen just 11 inches of rain since the beginning of September, almost 15 inches below normal, the National Weather Service said. The fire spread so quickly in southern Georgia that residents got no warnings or alerts. I wish that I had knew something more, said Brianna Elliott, who left home Tuesday only to find her route back blocked by the fires 90 minutes later. I would have turned around in that moment and gone home and got my animals before anything. She now fears that her home and dogs are gone. Georgia's two biggest wildfires together have burned more than 31 square miles, and at least four other smaller fires have been reported in the state. The fast-moving Brantley County fire was threatening roughly 1,000 homes Wednesday after destroying almost 50 a day earlier. That fire grew in size by roughly six times in just a half day Tuesday, said Joey Kaysen, the county manager. There were fires erupting in the backyard and people taking off in the front yard, he said Wednesday. So far, no major injuries have been reported, Carson said. The rural county is roughly midway between Georgia's coastal beaches and the Okefenokee Swamp and is dotted with livestock and fruit farms as well as thick stands of planted pines grown for timber. Crews were working to create fire breaks and stop flames from reaching populated areas. The biggest concern was the gusting winds that could easily spread embers. Authorities said rain was desperately needed. The area with the worst fires is an exceptional or extreme drought, the most dire levels, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. If you could start praying for that right now, we'd be grateful, Carson said. Pine and hardwood forests in the region are helping charge the fires, said Seth Hawkins, a spokesperson for the Georgia Forestry Commission. Swampy lowlands with thick layers of leaves and woody debris are super flammable when they dry out, he said. The commission's 30-day burn ban is for the southern part of the state. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp declared a state of emergency for more than half of the state's counties. More people were told to evacuate from Brantley County on Wednesday afternoon, on top of the 800 evacuations that had already taken place there. Another large fire that started in nearby Clinch County also prompted evacuations. Wounded veteran cleared to sue over suicide bombing. The Supreme Court on Wednesday cleared the way for a veteran wounded by a suicide bomb in Afghanistan to sue the government contractor for whom the attacker was working when he built the explosive. The court ruled 6-3 in favor of former Army Specialist Winston Ensley, who was wounded when he stopped a man on his way to detonate an explosive vest at a 5K race at Bagram Airfield on Veterans Day weekend in 2016. Ahmed Naeb instead blew himself up when he was confronted, killing five people and wounding more than a dozen, according to court documents. The projectiles fractured Hensley's skull and tore through his brain, leaving him without the full use of much of the left side of his body. He also has abnormal brainwave seizures and traumatic brain injuries, his lawyers wrote. An army investigation faulted the company's failure to supervise Naeb, an Afghan employee who built the vest on the job site, inside the base, court documents say. Hensley sued Fluor Corporation in South Carolina, where two of its subsidiaries are based, and made claims under the state's law for negligent supervision, negligent entrustment of tools, and negligent retention of an employee. The Irving, Texas-based engineering construction company argued that it could not be sued because it was working during wartime for the federal government, which is generally immune to lawsuits. The high court disagreed. The majority said companies are protected when they are fulfilling government contracts, but that Fluor allegedly failed to carry out its duties in supervising Naeb. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the opinion, joined by Justices Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Neil Gorsuch, Amy Coney Barrett, and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Panel recommends denial of permit for proposed solar farm. Council likely to vote on it at May 11th meeting. Gibson City Planning Commission members voted 6-1 to recommend to the City Council deny a developer's petition for a special use permit for the construction and operation of a proposed 2.25 megawatt solar farm on farmland just northeast of the city. The Commission's recommendation will be considered by the City Council during its May 11th meeting. Of the 16 members of the public present on the Council chambers for the Commission's meeting, an estimated 10 addressed the appointment panel, all speaking out against the project. I'm assuming that the same folks who were there and voiced some concerns will be there again on May 11th, said the Commission's chairman, Chase McCall. The developers who gave their presentation will also be there again. The developer, San Francisco-based Forefront Power, was represented at the meeting by its director of development, Jason Grissom. Also present were Larry Cruz of Champaign, who owns the involved farmland at the Ford County Road 600 East and Illinois 54 in Drummer Township, and Matthew Volbrecht, the Wetland Management Environmental Lead for Westwood Professional Services, an architecture and engineering firm. Most were in opposition, although including Bob Booz, who lived across the road from the proposed site, and other neighboring landowners like Brandon Roderick, Lori and Kevin Buse, Caitlin and Nick Brucker. Also, there were several other concerned citizens as listed in the meeting visitor sign-in sheet, including Tom Duringer, Sharon Stroh, Ruth Davis, Janet Iverson, Ryan Iverson, and Pat Ferris, plus resident Rob Schmidt. We heard issues from residents about the proximity of the solar farm to a couple of residences in the county. I think the nearest one was 350 feet from the solar farm, McCall said. We heard issues or complaints or concerns about glare from the solar farm. We heard issues about alleged toxicity of the solar panels, you know, for groundwater. These are just some of the bigger complaints that I think the members of the Planning Commission took into consideration with their vote. Among the seven commissioners present, McCall was the only one to vote in favor of the issuance of the permit for the project, which would be built on a 23,042-acre triangle parcel of land. I'm sorry, it's 23.42-acre triangular parcel of land to the southeast of Illinois 54. McCall said he voted to recommend approval because of the project's potential benefits to the community, including the temporary stimulation of the economy through the creation of jobs, an increase of tax revenue from the involved land for local taxing bodies, and the possibility that the city's residents could apply to receive energy credits on their utility bills via an agreement with Ameren Illinois. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, April 23rd, 2026. Please stay tuned for Part 2.